Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Strategy Series. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, and I hope everybody is having a very happy Passover. Joining us today is former Deputy Defense Secretary David Nordquist, who is now the President and CEO of the National Defense Industrial Association. He's joining us to discuss the strategic budget environment, but also NDIA's annual Vital Signs Report, 64 action-packed pages that serves as both a report card of the defense industrial base and its health, as well as a policy roadmap for the trade association and indeed all of Washington for the coming year. David, it's a real honor and pleasure to welcome you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Vago.
And before we get started, our coverage of strategy, strategic issues, and conversations with leading thinkers is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late great Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. This strategy series is not affiliated with the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation. David, great to have you on the program. Jennifer Stewart and the team at NDIA and all of its external participants did a terrific job on this year's 64-page Vital Signs Report. As I mentioned, it serves as both a status report of the industrial base. There's a very interesting and wide-ranging survey, both of industry and of government, to sort of understand how each side sees the other, and to forge a bit of a roadmap. Last year, you reiterated your call for a national defense industrial strategy, and that's exactly what the Biden administration rolled out earlier this year, a strategy that you and your members, as well as other bodies, AIA and Professional Services Council, also contributed to. This year, Jennifer and the team did something different. Before we get into the details of it, how is this year's report different from last year's, and why did you guys change the approach?
So I think the primary change was traditionally we had just surveyed industry and what are the challenges facing industry? What are the issues facing industry? But this year we expanded it and included government officials in our survey. So the total survey had 1,397 respondents, 568 government, 829 industry, universities, and nonprofits. And one of the things we wanted to look at is where did they have similarities and where did they have differences? And does everyone have a common understanding of the challenges coming up to us?
Which is a terrific way of doing it. So it's not an echo chamber of just one side talking about this. And I thought it was interesting. What I thought was interesting was pretty much everybody thought they were the same problems they were dealing with. But there was a difference in terms of scale, for example. And what I thought was also interesting is that some of them the government thought was actually worse than what industry thought. What, from the standpoint of the report, right, walk us from macro issues to micro issues, because you guys touched on all of these. What are the key recommendations and the key takeaways that you want folks to be left with after reading?
Sure. So let me sort of set up for your audience who may not have read this one or the previous one. In 2023, the primary takeaway that we had, as you mentioned, was that the defense industrial base is not sized or structured for great power competition. Over the last number of years, fewer people, fewer companies, a shrinking financial commitment from the government, less predictability from CRs and others, and a limited surge. And we emphasized you have a problem with your national defense strategy going one way and your defense industrial base going another. The Defense Department responded. They laid out the industrial strategy in, I think, December it was, which we thought was a very good step in the right direction. We can dive into that. So this year was sort of a follow-on where we looked at those common challenges. The most pressing, as you point out, the four were the same. Complex and protracted procurement process was the number one for industry, but it was also on the government's list. The federal budget process was actually the government's number one. And then supply chain challenges and workforce and recruiting. And what those show you is the places where industry and government is having a hard time executing the vision of the national defense strategy because it can't get technology to the field. It can't produce things in the scale and volume that is needed, as demonstrated by some of the demand signals in the Ukraine. One of the areas this shows up and we highlight in this report is there are many places where the government is on the brake and the accelerator at the same time. So the improvement over last year is there are many good things the government's trying to do. The challenge is there are parts of the government going in the other direction. So you talk about you want to attract non-traditional firms, exceptional. And then the government has a very aggressive definition of wanting to have access of intellectual property rights. Well, for many non-traditional firms, the intellectual property rights are the company. And so all of a sudden they see that and they step back. And we've seen in our surveys, there are companies who have avoided bidding or changed what they would bid out of fear of losing their intellectual property rights. Likewise, non-traditionals are not fond of governments with 6-month CRs. Because that's not the type of vendor that we're used to dealing with who can't make a decision or move. So I will go through more, but let me kick it back to you. But those are some of the setups to a series of, yes, you're on the accelerator, but you're also on the brake. And if we don't, and many of our recommendations are focused on getting off of the brake in order that the reforms can go forward.
The notion of getting off the brake, though, is something that, we began our career roughly at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we have been talking about this our entire career. 30 plus years ago, I began my career covering the 5000 series rewrite. Mm-hmm. And we are still sort of always sort of noodling at the edges as opposed to getting to the meat of the changes that are required, David, right? I mean, so mm-hmm. what are, and I'm going to ask you certainly about, you know, the mechanics of this and how to convince those people who play, you know, hold the defense budget hostage on a regular basis, unfortunately, right? I mean, as our mutual friend Todd Harrison of the American Enterprise Institute points out, right? I mean, a hostage is only valuable if his or her life is valued by the hostage takers. So the defense hostage doesn't really matter in this equation and sadly always ends up getting shot or at least mm-hmm. wounded. Right. I mean, even in the survey, the government folks were saying that this is a problem. Government mm-hmm. people discussed this as a problem. And yet it doesn't matter how heroic the efforts in order to try to change the system. Right. Definition of insanity is doing the same thing and hoping for a different outcome. So we're again noodle mm-hmm. on the edges. What are some substantive things that have to happen in order to drive us there? Because on the one hand, everybody says we have the authorities and can move mountains when we need to. On the other hand, you know, to your point about intellectual property, there are companies that are willing to give the intellectual property to the department if the department would only move faster, and the department doesn't move faster, right? I mean, so this is sort of the worst of all worlds, isn't it?
It can be. And so let's sort of walk through some of the recommendations, or I'll just pick certain topics. So let's start with supply chain. The government can prioritize different things when it buys. It has historically in the post Cold War or emphasized lowest marginal cost, which drives you to single suppliers. And that means you're not emphasizing resilience, you're not emphasizing capacity. And so if you want people to have second source suppliers, if you want to ensure that you have the resilience in the industrial base, you have to emphasize that in how you evaluate proposals. The acquisition committee is perfectly capable of changing what they ask for in a proposal and how they evaluate it. So if you say lowest marginal cost is more important than resilience, then that's what you'll get. If you emphasize resilience, people will bid resilience. There are, you know, issues of going back and understanding supply chain. Well, there are third-party mapping tools that can be used to do that. Now, there's some issues to figure out how far back you can go and what is it that government needs to know about the supply chain and what is it that's less important. But that's a particularly valuable one. One of the ones I'll just give a kudo to administration is multi-years for munitions, right? We have done multi-years on other platforms, but if you're producing something for the U.S. government, you have the strange sentence at the end of the contract that says, well done, Wesley, good job. I may cancel this contract next year. And so you end up with a difficulty in incentivizing companies to invest in production capacity when they don't know how long the production run's going to be. Right. If you said to Apple, by the way, we'd like you to produce iPhones, but we may stop you from selling them in 12 months. They're not going to ramp up their production capability as if they would if they knew they had a years and years of run. So by moving munitions to multi-years where a company can know that they're going to get a demand signal for 5 years, they can change what they do. They can go to suppliers and buy 5 years worth of parts from somebody who actually only needs a small run in order to fill their part of the supply chain. Many of those steps we've seen happen, and I want to give credit to people in the department who are making those reforms, but those are parts of the steps in the right direction. We're seeing real challenges in workforce. This is an issue with the shipyards, and we saw some money put in this bill over the weekend for submarines on the industrial base. But one of the issues is the skill career path of enlisted when they come out of the military used to be one of the main sources of skilled labor who understood the military mission, understood the equipment, and could be trained on or come out with the skill to be useful. We want the department to work on making sure that they have not moved away from skilled trade career paths as an option for those who are leaving the military, and making sure that that's a path, because that's part of your best source of people who can be cleared, people who have the skills and the knowledge.
Unfortunately, in the guise, as we've done this, too much of it was geared toward efficiency, right? And so we said, well, we shouldn't train these people to do these sorts of things because industry will do it. See, we can give them less money for acquisition programs. They'll play a bigger role on support. And that's how it'll happen, as opposed to the military being that engine of talent that then spreads throughout society, actually. And addresses all manner of workforce challenges, right? I mean, one of the big draws for going the military was you were going to learn trades at a level that would take you far longer and be far more expensive to do in the commercial world.
Right.
Let me take you to the question briefly of the industrial strategy. Right. We now have a first ever national defense industrial strategy. I'm one of the people who said that we always need this. This isn't a divorce. America has had industrial strategy before, even if we didn't call it. And you make industrial strategy with each acquisition you make. And it's far more acute when you only have a handful of contractors and you have to figure out, wow, this last award really could be problematic, for example, for Boeing or Lockheed or Northrop or whomever. So we get into problematic terrain sometimes. We have the report and it has been criticized a little bit because the annex to that is classified in terms of where the investment is going to go and how do we support it. And indeed, we're still doing this somewhat piecemeal, right? I mean, we have a CHIPS Act, but we don't have anything on printed circuit boards, which is 70% of that ecosystem, right? We're investing in parts of the industrial base, but not in other parts of the industrial base. How is this strategy being manifest, David? And what are the things that have to happen for us to be able to realize its potential? Because it's a terrific and well-written document. And yet there are a lot of folks who are saying, okay, well, in terms of the deliverable, ..
Right. And that's, first of all, that's always a fair criticism, but you always have to recognize that normally a strategy lays out where you're going. And the question is the follow-on work there, right? When this department issues the National Defense Strategy, it then converts it into a budget. Is the budget heading in the same direction as the strategy? So to start with, very well done by the department to, first of all, issue a strategy. And the second is the strategy makes clear that we didn't get here by accident, that the defense industrial base you have is the result of years of decisions that shrunk the industrial base, emphasized certain priorities over others. And so it explicitly calls for a generational rather than an incremental change. So the nice thing about this, the strategy is the first one is recognizing the problem and admitting you have one. And this one does that in a dramatic manner. The questions you're going to get to is when they talk about we need to have a resilient supply chain, we need to invest in extra capacity, we need to look at our stockpiles of parts and raw materials. Are they doing it? Are they investing the money in the budget that will get you the stockpiles? And some there's some places where they have in the budget release. Then the other one is, are they changing their contracts to invest in capacity and multiple suppliers? Those we'll see over time. But I think all of the right concerns about the strategy are less about the strategy than what's coming next. Are they going to follow through? And most importantly, is it going to get picked up by the department, or is this going to continue to have to be carried by an office within ANS? And most things in the department, if a single office is trying to drag everyone else along, it doesn't work well. If everyone else is educated and understands the problem, they look at the ammunition shortages from the Ukraine crisis and say, well, our demand signal is going to be even bigger than that. Then you start to get each organization carrying their piece because they see and understand the problem.
The good news is, I think that everybody does recognize the magnitude of the problem. And if you just look at the Navy's subset, there's an enormous investment. You know, everybody talks about the submarine industrial base. But I think the Navy and indeed each of the services has been working to try to diversify those sources of supply, given the supply chain is, you know, problematic across the piece. And indeed, inflation is most manifest in this through the supply chain. Do you get a sense that there is that universal understanding that this isn't just Bill LaPlante and Dr. Laura Taylor Calais and her team that are pushing this, but that there is actually, because there would seem to be, there seems at least, that there is a lot more activity going on at every level, which could be seen as encouraging, no?
There is, and I think that it should be encouraging, but one of the things I have found both my time in and outside the department is you educate across the leadership, and then it's got to penetrate into the drafting of a contract. And right. If people go back to the last time they issued the contract and do edits to it, right? You know, one of the issues that came up was inflation and the need to have clauses that make adjustments for inflation so you share the risk. Well, if those clauses aren't added to the contracts, then you really haven't changed anything going forward. And that's happening at the PM and PEO level, contract by contract. And so I think what vendors will see is, are they starting to see those changes showing up in the documents they're reading? I think you're right. We are seeing it from the leadership, which is always an essential first step.
It's well said from somebody who's tried to do this when you were on the Hill and certainly did it when you were in the department. And I want to ask you about that in a moment. Where do you see, right? I mean, everybody's looking at inflation as a driver, and obviously the impacts are different in commercial industry than it is on the Pentagon, right? Pentagon are a lot longer stream contracts. We've heard from Comptroller Mike McCord, your successor in the job. What's your sense? Because it's often a constrained supply chain that's really driving a lot of this, and right. Demand, whether on the commercial side or in the military side, has just soared. The economy continues to roar along, which is why inflation remains a problem. What's your impact on inflation and supply chain? Right? I mean, because labor, as you mentioned, also is an important piece of this equation, because people can't find the people to do the work, which is then also driving costs. What's your crystal ball tell you about where these trends are going over the next couple of years that we have to prepare for? It's going to cost the department more money, for example, at the end of the day, and it's already cutting into its buying power.
Right. I think one of the things for folks to understand is, if you're in the private sector and you want a bakery and inflation jumps 9% as it did in 1 year, you will notice that in the cost of the wheat and eggs you're buying. And you will go to the board in your bakery and you'll update the prices the next day or the next week on the board. And people will end up needing to absorb those, and you will be able to transition from lower to higher prices because you'll change your revenue and your expenses at the same time. Because of how long it takes the department to get its money and then how long it takes to put under contract and execute, we can see in government places where everything was planned on one number and then executed on a number. And who it affects depends on the timing. So I'll give you the two examples. If the budget for the program is submitted to Congress before the effect of inflation, which many of them were, and then the contract is awarded after the vendor sees what inflation is, the PM, the program manager, is in a jam. They've been given $100, which only has the buying power of 90. And so now they can't buy what the budget and the plan was. They either have to dial back its capability or dial back its quantity, because they can't afford what they were planning to buy with a budget that was assembled 2 years earlier and is now post-inflation. And so they get squeezed. The flip side is, the contract's been awarded. The vendor has a 2% inflation clause in it, but inflation's 9%. Now they're stuck with a contract that's underwater. And I'll give an example as a woman-owned small business down in Alabama, engineers. She has engineers on a contract. Well, their labor costs in the market just went up 9%, and she can't give them more than 2% raises and stay competitive. So she runs the risk of losing her talent, running in the red in a company that doesn't have the ability to do that for very long, or swapping out skilled for less skilled labor and then hoping that she can still perform on the contract. None of those are good options for us, which is why the slowness of the government creates this wrinkle and why it's so important to either put in resources to deal with inflation or put clauses in contracts that allow them to be adjusted.
One of the biggest problems, though, we face, that many, many years ago, we were part of, as I recall, a dinner discussion group that would address some of these challenges, mm-hmm. was delusionality by the system, right? Everybody wants their element of it. And yet, well, the resources that we make available don't exist, or we create policies to try to make it seem as though we're making it work. It is terrific. We have a $95 billion supplemental that whether for Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, or the Indo-Pacific. But at the end of the day, there are questions about whether even this large amount of money is sufficient for the task at hand. Sash Tusa of Agency Partners, who's a regular on our business roundtable, noted, you know, I mean, whatever Patriots you're building aren't going to be refilling your inventory is likely going to be used in almost real time by the Ukrainians to try to defend themselves, right? I mean, so winning, it may be a far, far larger number. Just like if we look at what we need to do in the Indo-Pacific to deter China, it's a much, much larger number, right? I mean, we've taken risk across almost every metric, from people to equipment to end items to processes, right, that we can't still get out of the way. What is a more honest number, David? You know, I mean, I don't want to give people sticker shock, but at the end of the day, folks have to have a little bit of a better sense on what that target needs to be, because deterring China is far cheaper, as we've seen in Ukraine, than actually fighting a war. What's a serious number for us to refill our magazines, help our allies and partners, and what is their role in us doing this and doing it more smartly? Because, you know, Lockheed working at its factories is only going to give you so many Patriots. So you may need many, many more Patriot factories and JASSM factories, multiply that by five.
So I think there are certain areas like munitions where we can clearly see that the volume and the capacity is not there, that we need to both increase the capacity, increase the volume, and the dollar amount that you should put is almost a reverse engineering of, well, what can you get industry to produce for you? Because you can look down range and recognize that the volumes of the missile fires in the Pacific will be extraordinary. I think you've seen some of the wargaming analysis of how people concerned about how quickly we run out. And the answer is, when you run out of bullets at the OK Corral, it's very bad. And so you need to be, so there's certain areas where we can clearly see that there's a volume there. You know, I'm not in government, so I'm not able to see the production capacities of some of these and what the options are. But those are very high. There are other places where you want to figure out, where do I have my priorities? And so one of the things that it comes to mind is, when you put a javelin in Ukraine and it destroys a Russian tank, you are short one javelin. But the other hand was, the javelin was there to shoot a Russian tank, and the Russian tank is now gone. And so at some point, those munitions are actually fulfilling a purpose for which they were originally built. That helps you recalibrate what is the posture that I need to have in Europe in order to deter the Russians, tracking both what they are building and what they are losing in capacity. I think as you look across the areas beyond munitions, you end at a place where the issue with ships is less the dollar value of the ships and the submarines than there is the backlog, which is, how do you get the workforce there to be able to produce the volumes? And so we have things that people don't fully appreciate is, people will sometimes reference defense as 50% of discretionary spending, and they think that means 50% of spending. And the answer is, there was a time back in the 60s when defense was 50% of federal spending. It's now between 13 and 15%. Defense used to be 10% of GDP, then 7%, then 5%. It's hovering around 3.2% and going down. So we are moving from just to still doing historically low size of the military, investment in the military dollars, compared to what we have done in the past. And we have to recognize, we're not in a post-Cold War era. Both parties recognize that the return of great power competition with China requires a turnaround. And yet our planning still has the trajectory and the misunderstanding that defense is as large as it was in your parents' time.
So how do we, right? I mean, so up on the Hill, where you spent a little bit of time before going, you know, you were in government, you were on the Hill, which is sort of government, and then you went private industry for a while before going back into government. the debate is so toxic at the end of the day that we end up operating for months at a time on continuing resolutions, which is basically you're hitting a pause button. I think, the Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall and General Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have sort of given a sort of a similar analogy. You're sort of tying my shoelaces in this race, or hamstringing me, and I'm starting at 25, a quarter late compared to everybody else, because it's a sort of a self-imposed penalty, using the race analogy. How do you change the conversation? I mean, how does the conversation in Washington have to change about this, right? The department has to do a better job in terms of how it is using those resources, not to impose time taxes of its own internally lead it to negative outcomes. On the other hand, you also need a steady stream of funding and support, and a broader national debate and discussion on how to use the nation's limited resources. Debt is a problem. I mean, this is the first year where servicing the national debt is more expensive than the defense budget. How do we need to shape this discussion as somebody who has experience, in government, but also up on the Hill, on how all the actors in this need to change the course, the discourse? You have to change entitlements. You have to change taxes.
So I think there's three steps to this. The first is understanding. I think there's too many people who believe that a CR is status quo and therefore is harmless. And, when you're talking before the Armed Services Committee, there's not that misunderstanding. But when you go to the rest of the Hill, there is, and in part, for many civilian agencies whose primary expense is civilian pay, it is sort of the status quo. Their job is to do a certain oversight, regulation, or make payments, and their last year looks very much like their next year. And therefore, the consequences of a CR are not very obvious. But in defense, as you point out, there's no new starts and no quantity increases. So if I have a new technology that's ready to go to the field that we have been in a race with China over, a CR says, hold off and give the Chinese another 3 to 6 months head start before we give you permission to begin to field that new technology. When you talk about the munition shortages, we knew we needed more GMLRS, the guided multiple launch rocket systems, in 17 and 18. We asked for increases every year, but the CR delayed the starts of those increases by 6 months and then 6 months again. So many of our munition shortages were contributed to by CRs, and many of our current CRs are going to create a munition shortage in the future. You have the same issue with readiness. If you cancel training because of the CR, you don't get it back, 3 months later, because somebody else is now on the range. So part of this is explaining to the rest of the Hill how wasteful of taxpayers' money a CR is. It's not harmless. It's not a chance of doing good. It's just a destructive way, because you're going to spend the same amount of money on the other side. You've just made sure you're spending it inefficiently. The second challenge is you've got to get the consequences of the CR onto the people who make the decision. There's always a discussion about, well, if we give any relief to the department, it will take off the pressure. The answer is, well, the department doesn't get a vote. So pressuring the department doesn't do a lot to move the bill. You have to make the consequences to come to a conclusion on the budget felt by the Hill. And I think the saddest thing when you see on it, they used to have a CR because there was some hot issue still being negotiated, and they'd have a week-long CR as they haggled out some item. But every day of the CR, they were negotiating to close. Now right. They kick the CR for 3 months and nobody's negotiating, right? And so it's just wasted time. The last item is, I think it's a recommendation that came out of the PPBS Commission, and it goes back to something that the Hill used to do, which is if the appropriators on the Defense House Appropriations Committee funded a project in their version of the bill and the Senate appropriators funded it in theirs, supporting a department increase, under the CR, you'd let the department go ahead and ramp it up. That way, if both committees agree ramping it up as a priority, it would happen. And that used to be how they'd write CR language, which was, if both committees agreed on a higher number, then that was okay to move forward. Some of those changes are going to have to come back until we can get the bills back to being passed on 1 October.
from your mouth to God's ears. And by the way, spoken like an appropriator, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's about the appropriators. I'm only joking for all of those authorizers, former recovering authorizers and current authorizers who are in the audience. Old joke. You mentioned the PPBE Reform Commission, the Planning, Programming, Budgeting, Execution System. You know, what are some other recommendations from that you think could be needle moving ultimately? Because it's how you move the money and use the money as both a discipline tool, an enforcement tool, a strategy tool at right. the end of the day, right? And we still make mistakes that cost us many, many billions of dollars, right? But what's your sense on some of the other important proposals included in there that you think are, you know, folks should most be focused on?
Sure. So there's a number of them. I mean, one of them you start with is the entire structure. And I'll start with the appropriations. You point out that's my background, but it's the funding of the bills is still based on the industrial model of something goes through research and stops. It then goes into procurement and then is fielded, and then it's in maintenance. So I have colors of money, R&D when I'm developing you, procurement when I'm buying you, O&M when I'm maintaining you. And then you go to a software company who's writing software, and you say, tell us when you're done with the development of the software. And they say, I'm never done with the development of the software. Well, tell me what it takes to go into production. The answer is, production is just stopping my development and saying, here's your copy. It's not like it's an entire phase. And then what's maintenance? Well, every maintenance includes an upgrade. The amount of time the department spends trying to guess whether the change coming in 2 years is a research and development thing because it's a capability upgrade, or whether it's maintenance and then budgeting for it only to discover it's wrong, really reflects that we have the wrong model. Now, however the appropriators give the money by paragraph, we'll define the colors of money at that time. But the committee recommends that you don't make R&D, procurement, and O&M the walls. You start with the service, you go down to the mission. You may at the lowest level have color of money for tracking purposes, but really it's less important whether something was R&D, procurement, or maintenance than whether it was surface warfare, ground attack, long-range missiles, whatever your division. And again, the Congress would still control quantity. I mean, the whole point about the report was not to change congressional authority, but to say, are you really controlling the things that matter? A couple other recommendations. One is more agility, whether it's below threshold reprogrammings or others, to be able to respond to a new technology faster than the two-year cycle. It's always important to get rid of use it or lose it at year end by having some carryover money. Having carryover money is rational behavior by rational people, and not allowing them to do that puts the department into a position of making inefficient choices. And I think one of the biggest ones, and the reason why there's a proposal to change the name from PPBE to the Defense Resourcing System, is one of the most important changes is to load up front the analytics before the services start to build their POM, where you look at the outcome of the war games, you look at the outcome of the analysis, and you have a series of meetings, not just a memo, defense planning guides, but a series of meetings that gets clarity on how is the enemy changed, how is the threat changed, and you use that strategy to more explicitly drive your process. So you move from the current PPP to a strategy phase, a resource allocation phase where you do guidance, you build and make decisions, and then the traditional execution, with eliminating the distinctions between the CAPE Comptroller programming budgeting phases, which right now run somewhat sequentially, many times hit similar topics, and then you currently have two different databases issuing two different sets of guidance. That is very difficult for services. And so we propose to consolidate that for clarity. But revamping the process to focus on getting outcomes for your strategy, and then redesigning or having the appropriators work to redesign the colors of money to control the things you actually care about.
Let me ask you one last question, because this conversation sure. could go on for an hour, but we only have a couple more minutes of your time, which is on the requirements process. Requirements can be meaningful or they can be BS. Once upon a time, requirements didn't span many thousands of pages. They were pretty focused, and we were trying to harness innovation and moving the ball forward quickly. Whereas now, we have complex requirements for systems that actually don't make sense, survive oversight, And then end up getting canceled after having consumed a lot of resources. Folks will say the future armed reconnaissance aircraft is one of those, consumed a lot of resources, and it's unclear what we're delivering. Future combat systems was another one of those programs, although that did generate quite a lot of technology that went into other, did go into other platforms and will go into other platforms. But what's your sense on the right way to do this? Because it drives industry cost, it drives complexity. There's sometimes not as much reason in it. There's technological ambition or delusion, right? What are the ways to think about requirements? Because that came up in Vital Signs as well, as in terms of something problematic that we still haven't gotten our arms wrapped around.
So the challenge is requirements can act like handcuffs, where you get to a program manager and they've got X number of requirements they have to meet. And somebody comes to them with a new and innovative solution that would dramatically improve the project, but it's not on one of their requirements, so they can't do anything with it. And it is one of the major barriers to incorporating new innovation, is trying, it doesn't fit, but it also handcuffs you to exactly those sets and removes the flexibility in some ways to adapt to different circumstances, to new ideas, to changes in cost. It also has to, there's sort of an underlying, my understanding is, of the driver, which is if you only get to design a new plane once every 10 years, the pressure to try and put everything into it is extraordinary. But if you're a software company who's updating your technology in an app, you're going to do it every month. So you're constantly putting in small updates and others, and big ones can wait, and you don't wait on the longest pole in the tent to move. So right. One of the challenges is some of this is a side effect of buying fewer things less often, puts much more weight on the few things that you're buying. And there's a risk of people trying to jam very forward-looking capabilities with the theory that, well, it's going to take you 7 years to build it anyhow. So maybe sometime in the next 5 years, we'll actually figure out technologically how to make this happen, versus fielding what you're able to do with current design and then researching until the next generation has proven itself.
Let me just briefly ask you one last question before we go in the 30-second lightning round. You were among a long line of former comptrollers who became deputy defense secretary. You know, Bill Lynn was in that category. The great John Hamry was in that category. You're in that category. What's the role of comptrollers in driving innovation? We have a tendency of thinking about this on the acquisition and sustainment side or the research and engineering side, as opposed to thinking actually comptrollers play a tremendous role. You know, we're doing an APEX, you know, we're partnered on the APEX conference with Clarion Defense, which is going to try to take some more innovative approaches to what, you know, defense innovation looks like. From your perspective, what's the role of comptrollers in trying to help accelerate and shape this? Because when it comes to finding money, nobody's better. When it comes to using money, nobody's better. And when it comes to using money as both reward and punishment, nobody's better, right? Because the conversation, I think, ends up talking about kind of the technology piece as opposed to the folks who actually, you know, use the rule of reason to fund things or defund them.
So comptrollers are one of those positions that's uniquely set up in the department. First of all, they engage with the leadership on a regular basis because most issues in the department at some point have a money angle to them. The second is they have an overview of the entire department. They're working with every single office. They're assembling a budget that funds the entire operation. So you come in with enormous perspective and very little of self-interest in it because the comptroller shop is assembling everybody else's money. There's very little to be protective of. But it also lets you, one, move obstacles out of other people's way. You know, if the secretary has a priority, the comptroller is the one who is able to prevent other people from spinning their wheels trying to get resources for it by saying, it's a secretary priority. I will help you get there from here. Focus on execution. But just to use your point about driving change and innovation, I'll just pick one example. When I was at the department, we started doing the financial statement audit. And there's many people who have strong opinions, pro and con, of the audit. But what people didn't seem to realize was the audit was one of our tools that allowed us to create Advana and data analytics, because the department's databases were not set up to transmit data at the transaction level, which is what data analytics requires. But the audit requires that. So by building a data lake and having different parts of the department for the audit send you transaction level data that you then cleaned up to meet audit standards, all sorts of analysis was now possible that's led to the CDAO and other changes on maintenance, all of which really came because the comptroller office started the audit and used that, knowing that it was like, give me a place to place my lever and I can move the world. Give me a place where I can concentrate data from the department in an accurate data lake, and I will give you a very different running department. But the audit was the story and the message that got you there.
David, thanks so very much for being so generous with your time. Terrific conversation. You're welcome back anytime. And I mean that, as there are many other conversations that we would love to have you participate in. Thanks so very much. And best of luck at NDIA and great work to Jennifer and the entire team on the Vital Signs Project. Well done.
Her team did great. And Vago, thank you for having me on.
An honor and pleasure. And everybody, thanks very much for spending time with us. We appreciate it. Join us tomorrow for our conversation on the future of land warfare, as well as the latest in Ukraine, as the United States provides more aid, but Russia is likely to go more punitive in the near term. Thanks very much. We'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.